per corner, and he'll either stop it at 7.5 or set it at 7.5. I'll leave that up to the marshal. So the point being is, Ms. Stoll, you'll just pay attention to that, of course. Otherwise, the timelines would be at the same 50 minutes for both combined compellent appellant's counsel, 15 minutes for respondent's counsel, and then we'll assume Ms. Stoll then will have the 5 minutes of rebuttal at that point. If at any time we lose connection, the marshal knows to stop the clock, so then we wait until we're all reconnected. But welcome to the Court of Appeals to March 9. This is the third of three oral arguments. Judges Johnson and Hooten joining me, Judge Sleater presiding in this matter. And for the record, this third of three oral arguments are the combined files A21349 and A21351 in the matter of the welfare of the child of KK and KMR. And I'll just note also for the record for participants that any recording of this proceeding is prohibited, but we will be within 24 hours, the recording will be posted on the Judicial Branch's website. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed. If you want to identify yourself first, and then you may proceed. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Mallory Stoll. I am the court-appointed attorney for KMR, the father in these proceedings. KMR is requesting a reversal and remand of the district court's order terminating his parental rights involuntarily to his son. Just as a very brief summary of the facts, this appeal arises from an order involuntarily terminating KMR's parental rights. The district court found by clear and convincing evidence both grounds alleged in the petition to terminate parental rights, and furthermore found by clear and convincing evidence that the agency had made reasonable efforts to reunify and that those had been unsuccessful, and furthermore that it was in the best interest of the child to involuntarily terminate both parents' rights. In my brief, KMR does raise several issues on appeal. My plan is to focus primarily on the issue of reasonable efforts, as well as the manner in which the district court procured testimony from the minor child in this proceeding, the minor child now being 15 years old, I believe. So starting with just viewing this record and what really stands out in terms of reasonable efforts, Your Honor, KMR submits to this court that the reasonable efforts were lacking in numerous respects. And when we look at the law that applies to an analysis of reasonable efforts, not only must the department prove that by clear and convincing evidence, but furthermore, find that they failed to correct the conditions leading to the out-of-home placement. And the reasonable efforts in this case really pertain to two of the three steps of the analysis, both with regard to whether a ground in the petition was proven by clear and convincing evidence, but also just the ultimate inquiry of reasonable efforts itself. KMR submits that the reasonable efforts were most lacking, not only in terms of involving the parents in the child's various services. We did have a child in this case that had many needs, a significant cognitive delay, and some pretty significant accommodations for his educational needs. But we also have reasonable efforts that we look at in terms of visitation. I will certainly acknowledge to the court that there really isn't a whole lot of case law that is precedential on this court that deals with reasonable efforts as it pertains to a visitation plan and what visitation is appropriate.
Well, in this case, though, I mean, there was a lot of evidence that the child did not want to see the parents and had some emotional issues with regard to that. I mean, don't we have to look at the totality of the evidence and figuring out if what was reasonably provided takes into consideration that factor?
Judge Hooten, you took the words right out of my mouth in that I agree. It is a totality of the circumstances analysis, But what I think is particularly important and relevant here is that the various witnesses that testified, the FCC supervisors, Winona County Human Services, they based their actions and their interventions in this case almost exclusively on the child's resistance to visits. And I think that furthermore, when you look at the totality of the circumstances and who KLR is as a child, those efforts just simply did not rise to the level of reasonable. And I think that the facts that most importantly support that are the fact that KLR was not really given much of any notice when these visits were happening. There were several months in between the parents, when the parents were in custody in Winona County and when FCC, the Supervised Visitation Center, even began exploring this issue of visitation. And another really important, I think, point to make is when we look at the transcript in this matter, it doesn't seem that there was a focus on why this child was so resistant to visits and what interventions could have been put in place to make him more comfortable with these visits.
Well, I mean, just looking at the order, it seemed like a big problem was the father's inability to not be confrontational and yell. I mean, the child was very affected by the father yelling so much. And that, I mean, looking at that, I mean, is there anything in this record that shows that the father was able to modify that behavior and not be so confrontational and not yell so much?
So, Your Honor, I will make sure to review the record for rebuttal to determine if there is a specific part of the transcript that addresses it. But I want to answer that in a slightly different way. And what I mean by that is KMR really wasn't given an opportunity in the presence of KLR to demonstrate that he has made changes. Again, when we get back to reasonable efforts.
Well, what in the record indicates that the parents made changes in their behavior and their attitude and their outlook? Because the key thing that brought this case to child protection was their failure to provide an adequate education and to provide for the special needs of the child. Yet, one of the things the judge brought up is they actually went through counseling without even mentioning these issues in child protection. And there was a concern by the child and others that if child protection wasn't involved, or if they ceased to be involved, that they'd go back to what they were doing before, which was basically not sending the child to school and not making sure his needs were met. What is there in the record to contest that or that would make the judge's findings on that clearly erroneous and the ultimate determination abuse of discretion?
Mm-hmm. And so, Your Honor, what I would say is in reviewing the district court's order, I was not trial counsel in this matter. There was a long history in this case between the judge and the parents, and I do really think, given the charged nature of some of the findings made, and in my brief, I did cite to several examples of findings that KMR believes are clearly erroneous. But things that I can come up with off the top of my head, KMR did take KLR to several appointments and assessments at the early stages of this case, when child protection was initially involved and KLR was in the parents' care. The parents also changed their mind and their perspective and testified to the same regarding the child attending public school and programming. So I think that also was the case. And I think also the testimony of Mr. Sato, who served as KMR's individual therapist, also acknowledges that there were discussions about child protection and the stress that this had on KMR. So off the top of my head, Judge, those are some examples that I can think of. And so I do see my time is very quickly ticking off here. The only point I just want to make with regard to the matter in which the child's testimony was procured, respondent argues that issue was not properly preserved for appeal. I do want to bring the court's attention to a case that actually was cited by respondent. It's In Re SSW 767 Northwest 2nd, specifically at page 733, which provides that even when there is no motion for a new trial or amended findings, when there are concerns about evidentiary issues, the scope of review on appeal also includes substantive legal questions not raised in post-trial motions, but properly raised during the trial. The specific citations to the record that note both KK and KMR properly preserved that issue for appeal would be at the transcript beginning at page 334, where there's a conversation with KK's trial counsel and KMR's objections specifically to not only the manner, but the child testifying can be found at the transcript at pages 402 and 403. So with that, I will go ahead and turn over the remainder of the initial argument.
Okay, so you're saying that the transcript shows that there was not only an objection to the child testifying, but also as to the manner?
Yes, Your Honor. And just to clarify quickly, Mr. Nelson, KK's trial counsel, KMR was self-represented. At that initial part of the transcript objected not only to the child's testimony, but also the manner, raising serious concerns about the inability to cross-examine the child with that method. Then when we look at the transcript at pages 402 and 403, where the district court revisited the issue of the child's testimony, KMR indicated not only an objection, but an agreement with Mr. Nelson's statements and objections.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tolla. Mr. Schatz, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. Michael Schatz, attorney for appellant KK. May it please the court. My focus will be on the issue of the child's testimony and whether there was an error by the district court in prohibiting the parents and the attorneys and everyone besides the judge and the guardian ad litem from participating in the testimony and cross-examining the child. This is clearly a critical issue for the trial court. It goes to reunification efforts, reasonable efforts, the ultimate issues at trial. Essentially, as the court knows, what happened is the testimony of the child who was 14 going on 15 with some mental health issues was taken outside the presence of everybody. There's really no discussion of why, and I think that's a key issue before the court today, how it would happen or why it would happen. This is true for both the mid-trial decision by the district court judge when the decision was made, as well as the pretrial order from 8/28/2020, which is cited in the addendum. And that leads to a few violations of Minnesota statutes 260C.163. Specifically, Your Honors, there's subdivision 7. And that states, you know, that the minor child could be removed from the proceeding temporarily for good reason. But it also goes on to state, I may not be quoting exactly, but essentially that even if that happens, the attorneys have the right to continue and to participate in the proceedings in the absence of that parent or that minor. So in this case, we were not afforded that. I was not trial counsel as well, but counsel for the appellants were not provided the opportunity to participate in the testimony of the child. Subdivision 8, there's a few violations there as well. Not only the child's rights were violated because the child had the right to be heard and participate, but the parents' rights were violated under subdivision 8 as well, because they were entitled to cross-examine all witnesses. And the child was a witness in this case. And lastly, Your Honor, subdivision 10 of that same statute was violated. The child must waive in writing his or her participation in the trial. And that clearly did not happen here. I think the record's clear about that. But the exact opposite occurred. The child indicated that the child wanted to participate, wanted to testify, and then the judge unilaterally limited that testimony, and I'm doing air quotes for the record, because it wasn't really testimony. It was just a few discussions from the judge that provoked some responses from the child.
Well, doesn't 260C.163, subdivision 6, allow the court on its own motion or the motion of any party to take the testimony of a child informally?
It does, Your Honor. Two things about that, though. One, none of those provisions that were talked about, such as the attorneys could submit questions or things of that nature that are given as examples, were provided to the parties in this case. It was just a decision of this is how we're going to do it, and that's that. Second, subdivision 7, 8, and I would argue 10 would still need to be complied with in that case, which is, for example, the right to cross-examine and the right to be present. So it does afford those opportunities, and we've seen it before, but it still was not complied with, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Schatz, assuming if we agree that there was an error, I assume you agree, though, we still have to look at the prejudice of that error. And wouldn't it be true, and this is part of what respondent points out, is you'd look at all of the other evidence to see whether the court's findings were supported by that, even if one was to exclude what he said to the court or perhaps was redundant of what's separately in the findings. Would that be your understanding of how we would do that sort of a prejudice analysis?
Correct, Your Honor. There still needs to be a prejudicial effect, even if there was an error. I agree with that assertion. In this case, we are talking about the ultimate issue. We do have issues related to reunification efforts, as Attorney Stoll pointed out, and I think there are some serious issues there, although I'll leave it to her to talk about. But, for example, the child could have been questioned about why the child changed their mind about visits, which is in the record, wanted visits, then didn't want visits. The reasoning for the change, the reason for the letter under exhibit, I think it's exhibit number one, that the child wrote, there's lots of things the child could have been questioned about, probably should have been questioned about, that could lead to conclusions about the ultimate issue in this case, such as one of the best interest factors, which is the child's desire, as well as several other issues regarding reunification efforts. I do think it's a substantial issue in this case. Without those questionings, I think it is a prejudicial finding that the court needs to revisit.
Were your client given the opportunity to cross-examine the guardian ad litem who did appear with the child during the Zoom session?
There was a testimony from the judge, I should say, an order from the judge that the guardian ad litem would be available. However, given the very limited testimony of the child and not subject to cross-examination, I don't think that opportunity was taken advantage of. I don't think there was much to take advantage of in that case.
Judge Slater, may I ask one question?
Yes, you may.
Mr. Schatz, do you have subdivision 6 in front of you? If not, I can read it. But the last sentence of that subdivision says the court may excuse the presence of the child's parent, et cetera, from the room where the child is questioned in accordance with subdivision 7. Does that sentence justify the district court's ruling here, or the manner of taking testimony?
I believe that's similar to Judge Hooten's question, if I understood it correctly, which is there may be removal from the room, but subdivision 7 says that the attorneys and the other parties still have the right to be present for that. So while a child may be removed from the trial temporarily, if it's in the best interest of the child, and the parent may be removed temporarily for good cause, and again, I would argue there was no good cause. The child didn't even say he had concerns at that point, just that he didn't want to miss school. But subdivision 7 still needs to be complied with, which it clearly was not.
I mean, subdivision 7 is about the waiving of the presence of the minor, but that didn't happen here, right? I mean, this is a different procedure than that, isn't it?
Subdivision 7 also relates to the parent. It actually says child, comma, parent. And then the last sentence does also mention parents. It says if the attorney or guardian ad litem, if any, has the right to continue to participate in proceedings during the absence of the minor, comma, parent, comma, or guardian. So I think it does anticipate that if the parent is taken out of the room in the best interest of the child, the attorneys would still need to be present for it. And I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, well, yeah. What if I may go back to subdivision six, last question. The court may excuse. Does that mean the court may excuse the child's parent at the child's parent's request, or does that mean the court may involuntarily dismiss the child's parent from the courtroom with, you know, without a request by the parent?
Well, I've been wrong before, Your Honor, maybe once, but I believe that it complies with subdivision seven, which would say if it's in the best interest of the minor. I think those are the factors that would be taken into effect. And again, I argue there was no indication that best interests were met. There's no indication that there was any best interest factors identified, and therefore they're invalid.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and counsel for respondent. If you would identify yourself, you may then proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Rebecca Church. I'm an assistant county attorney with Winona County, and I represent Winona County Health and Human Services, the respondents in this matter. Your Honor, the arguments focused on by the opposing counsel are inaccurate. The court's findings do clearly show that reasonable efforts were made, and the court clearly laid out why it was making the decision to take the child's testimony as it did, and that it was in the child's best interest. Additionally, even if the court found it to be error, as my brief clearly points out, it was not prejudicial because there was only two findings of the 200 some that really focused on the child's testimony. Additionally, everything that the child said, for the most part, was said by several other witnesses.
What about the argument that the child, that there was no determination by the court that proceeding in this manner and taking the testimony of the child without the parents or the parents' counsel present was in the child's best interest?
Your Honor, in my recollection of the order from August, the court specifically talks about how it is in the child's best interest. Additionally, Your Honor, in the transcript, the court has a long explanation of what the court was thinking and why it was thinking of doing so. Part of that explanation can be found on page 403. Explaining what her thought was. And she explains, how she was thinking about this. I believe even one of the appellate's briefs talk about how she refers to Dr. Wood's testimony. So she clearly lays out on the record what her thought process was and why it was in the best interest of the child to do it this way. Additionally, the record is clear how the child felt about the parents. The child heard his father's voice, I believe, on a March 12th visit with FCC on the phone and screamed and asked to be hung up and ran from the room. The child clearly described how he felt after the April 2020 visit. The child, as Ms. Carls, one of the guardian ad litem, explained, the child coiled into a ball at the talk of parents. So just the thought of having the child testify in front of the parents when the child didn't even want to hear father's voice clearly is not in the best interest of the child. And I believe the court lays that out both in her order and from August and in the record. And the evidence in this case shows it as well.
Ms. Church, your brief talks about subdivision six and seven. What about subdivision eight, which says that the parents, have a right to cross-examine witnesses appearing at the hearing?
Your Honor,
was that complied with, or was that?
I believe it was complied with, Your Honor. They were given an opportunity to follow up and ask, now that you've said this part, we want the child to explain this. The court also made it very clear that the guardian ad litem would be testifying and she could be asked questions. They could have also called the child on their case in chief. And so there was many opportunities in which that could have been remedied. Did the court specifically say, what cross-examination questions do you want to ask? Obviously not, that's not in the record. However, there have been times when I've been in trial that a party's been overlooked. So it's not that that is unheard of, that you're not specifically asked when you have several attorneys and several things going on. That may be overlooked. However, they had the opportunity. I would also respectfully disagree that there was an objection to the process. My very quick review of the pages she points out, and I was in the trial, and my recollection is as well that, again, the argument consistently was that he should not, the child should not testify, which was different from throughout the case when the parents said, you know, he should have his voice heard and he wants to be with us. And then they argued that he should not testify. He should not testify. To the best of my recollection in a quick review of the transcripts, and I had reviewed them obviously while writing the brief, they never specifically said, I object to this process. I want this process. You know, they objected to the child should not testify at all. And now on appeal, they argue the child didn't testify enough. So it's like arguing both ends of the spectrum. I would also note that the rules point out that parents can be excused during child's testimony. So Mr. KMR, who was not represented, could be excused. And that's obviously very unfair if he's excused and the other two attorneys get to stay in there. So I think the court, looking at fairness for everybody, excused all parties except the guardian ad litem. And then the guardian ad litem was available to follow up with any questions.
Are you referring to the last sentence of subdivision 6? The court may excuse the presence of the child's parent?
Yes, Your Honor.
So so it does excuse there mean, you know, if the child's parent requests to be excused, or does it mean the court may exclude the child's parent?
Your Honor, my reading of it is that the court may excuse the presence of the child's parents, that the court may do that is an option that the court has. This is,
But in response to, the parents expressed desire to be excused, or what if the parent doesn't want to be excused and wants to stay in the courtroom? Does that sentence authorize the district court to exclude the parent?
I think it does, Your Honor. I think in looking at the subdivision as a whole, that subdivision is talking about what the court is allowed to do, to take the child's witness informally, to ask for questions beforehand or afterwards, in addition, excuse the parents. So my reading of the subdivision as a whole is that the court may on its own accord excuse the parents. Obviously, looking at the best interest of the child, and clearly in this case, that would have been in the best interest of the child. The child has clearly expressed that to so many professionals, wrote a letter, in fact. There's really no dispute what the child's position was. And I think ultimately at the end, the court, as it noted, had the child even testify, so the child didn't feel excluded, so the child's voice could be heard because the child expressed wanting that. Up until then, I acknowledge there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of discussion at the pretrial and during the trial. The trial very well has a transcript of that, of the judge's thought process throughout that. And ultimately, there were several times when I was coming back into the courtroom, the judge was saying nope, and then the child's attorney would be like, hold on, and it was a lot of back and forth in and out of the courtroom. And ultimately the court had a lot to think about and a lot to weigh. And I think the court did that appropriately. I thought the court laid that out in the transcript and really took in what was the best interest of the child and what in order to assure that the child had his voice heard, but also was not re-traumatized in any way. Your Honor, there was also arguments about reasonable efforts. The county obviously believes that reasonable efforts were gone above and beyond. Visits were specifically noted. Visits were tried in a number of different ways. From the very beginning, when the child was brought back to Minnesota in August, because the parents fled with the child and took the child all over the place, which was not in his best interest as the court found or thinking of the child's welfare. When the child was brought back, the child from the beginning said, I do not want visits with my parents. I do not want visits with my parents. And so, Your Honor, I would like to deeply apologize to the court. I've been on Zoom all morning. I've been on Zoom for the last year, and that hasn't happened. So I'm so sorry.
It has happened before us occasionally, so don't need not, but thank you. And we're glad that you're back. We did stop the clock, I think, relatively soon, right after you, we lost your audio. So you may continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. What are Your Honors? What I was speaking about was the reasonable efforts really surrounding visits, because that seems to be the major argument. And as I noted, throughout this process, the county really stepped up. Am I still with you?
You are, although the picture froze, but we were able to hear you. So if that happens again, you might want to just turn the video off and we'll see if we still hear you, but why don't you try it again?
Thank you. We continue to make efforts where we expanded visits. We got FCC involved. We had visits scheduled twice a week for years. As far as arguing that the child wasn't aware of that, these visits were scheduled. It's not like FCC just popped in. Foster parents worked with the child on these visits, and it became pretty routine. I believe one of the monitors mentioned that the child at some point kind of got annoyed because they knew what was going to happen. Not only did the monitor show up and ask for visits if he wanted to have a face-to-face visit, ultimately they were expanded to offer phone calls. He was offered to write letters. He was offered to color. We got his therapist, Dr. Woods, involved. The guardian ad litem and the social worker continued to work with the child. And the foster parent also continued. Additionally, there was a face-to-face visit in April that went incredibly poorly. And so...
We're starting to lose your video again, really, Ms. Church.
No doubt that the child was...
I think we lost her again.
Does that make it better, Your Honor?
It does. Yeah, we can hear you fine. And you're at about 4:03 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. I really think that I covered pretty clearly in my brief and in my arguments here that reasonable efforts were above and beyond. Parents didn't take those opportunities. Parents didn't work with the child's therapist. Parents didn't work on themselves to make the child more comfortable with wanting to see them. And parents and specifically father continued to be hostile and obstructionist, again, as the child clearly saw in the April visit. So Your Honors, the court did not err in any of its findings. The findings clearly are supported by the facts. Specifically, they found reasonable efforts and laid them out. And they did not err by allowing the child to testify. Even if the court finds that there was some error, it was not prejudicial because there was many other facts laid out in the petition, in the trial that supported the findings. Thank you. I yield any more of my time, unless there's further questions.
Does not appear to be any, Ms. Church. I appreciate that. And we'll note that as long as you're part of the participants, we'll assume you're still listening. And now we do see you. Thank you. Now, Ms. Stahl, I understand you'll be doing the rebuttal then for 5 minutes. So you may proceed. I have a overriding question I want to ask you, Ms. Stahl, and Ms. Church kind of referenced it, and Judge Hooten asked about it earlier. The judge made a lot of findings that painted a pretty good picture, I thought, for us, which seemed the parents, but in particular your client, since we're talking to you right now, were resistant to any involvement of child protection. And there was one finding I was thinking of in that regard, 104, and I'll just read it so you don't have to necessarily find it. It was on page 23 of the court's order. Father never made any effort or acknowledgement that he needed to improve his parenting. And I saw similar findings related to mental health. I guess my question goes to your point, your argument about reasonable efforts. Would you agree, number one, as a matter of law, the key is to offer the services, but if a parent is not willingly accepting those, then that that has been met. And how should we analyze that in relation to the court's order? And given at least my understanding of the kind of the big picture the court painted in terms of the parents' willingness to take part in these services.
Judge Sleater, my response to that would be in this case, I do agree that the record does have indications of resistance and skepticism by KMR to work with social services. But in addition to the examples I provided to Judge Hooten during my initial remarks, there are additional indications within the transcript that while he may not have come out and said explicitly to anyone, I need help, this is what I've done wrong, I think looking at his actions is something that this court certainly can and should do. In addition to the examples I cited, looking at the transcript, KMR did indicate not only a desire to ensure that KLR continues to be enrolled in public school, but that there were efforts already being made. I don't recall off the top of my head the district court specifically finding that uncredible. I do know the court did make one point as to credibility based on some of the events in the past that she thought there was no way they would follow through. I think that's a bit grandy. I don't know if the findings support that, but certainly part of it is a credibility determination. And I think, again, just at the backdrop of all of this, what's really important to keep in mind with the parents' engagement is that they weren't allowed more than one in-person visit with their child over 12 months. And I did cite in a footnote to my brief, in my brief, the importance and how critical visitation is. And I think that the agency tried to put this on FCC to say, well, that's who we contracted it to, and that's their policies. But FCC doesn't have an obligation to provide reasonable efforts to reunify. And KMR submits there was more that the court could do. And I think in addition to some of the issues raised with regard to just transitioning to the child's testimony, the manner that this was conducted with obtaining the child's testimony is really troubling and contrary to 260C in numerous respects. The fact that it doesn't appear anyone was even allowed to submit questions, that the court characterized this as a meet and greet and then asked if he likes living with his foster parents. Those are just a couple that really stand out to me. And the fact that no one was allowed to be in there but the guardian ad litem, and the district court's solution was, well, you can cross-examine the guardian ad litem. But the guardian ad litem isn't going to be able to elaborate on any of the information given by the child. The guardian ad litem is only going to be able to talk about what she observed and what the child said. And I don't think that looking at the prejudice in this case with how the child's testimony was obtained and the conditions with that, it touches more than the explicit findings of fact that the district court made regarding the child's testimony. Yes, we have findings 70 and 71 that explicitly talk about the child's preferences, but the conclusions of law also contain citations to the child's testimony. The fact that he wanted to be adopted by his foster parents was taken into account. And there was one other mention in the conclusions of law with regard to the child's testimony. So I don't think that it can be looked at as that narrow. And I think that just to briefly conclude, if I might, Judge Sleater, time is up. I also want to just point out that, looking at the unpublished QSM case in which Judge Johnson concurred specially, I think really sets forth the crux of KMR's argument, which is there's nothing that allowed the process and the procedures that the district court dictated with regard to the child's testimony. The court went back and forth numerous times, and the fact that the district court took it upon herself to create this process was not only in violation of Minnesota law, but arguably was a serious due process concern. And so I'll conclude by asking your honors that this court reverse the termination and remand for further proceedings and direct the court to create an updated case plan and have the parents continue working towards reunification. I have nothing further.
Very well. Appears to be no other questions from my colleagues. And Ms. Church, I believe I saw you on the list of participants, so even though you shut down your video, you've been able to hear fully to the end. Is that correct?
That is correct. I shut my video because my internet continues to be unstable. And again, I deeply apologize to the court.
That's okay. Maybe just needs a rest from all the Zooming you've been doing, and it'll rehabilitate itself. Thank you to all counsel. We appreciate your comments today, answers to our questions, as well as your briefing, because this is a termination case that we'll be considering it on an expedited matter, and we'll be issuing an order accordingly. So you all may have a good day. Thank